Welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show. I am Matthew Aaron, www.thematthewaaronshow.com, at Matt Aaron Show on Twitter. If you go to Facebook and you type in the Matthew Aaron Show, you can click like, and you will get all the updates on our fabulous show we have here. We're on Stitcher. We're on so many things. It's not even funny. I was going through the worldwide statistics today. To our fans, that we have a lot of fans in Canada, understandable. I'm a big Canuck fan. But like Pat and I were just like, we have a lot of fans in Turkey, awesome. Saudi Arabia, cool. Poland, Germany, I mean, a pretty decent percentage. Like, the Matthew Aaron Show is back and is more worldwide than ever. So today on the Matthew Aaron Show, all you worldwiders, you'll be happy to know that we have Dean Devlin on the show, and he's got to be big worldwide. This guy's Independence Day, baby. Godzilla, the librarians, you know, this is worldwide stuff, leverage. But I mean, if when you think of Independence Day, you think of the whole world being attacked. Well, Dean Devlin is going to attack things with us today, and then Trevor Moore will be joining me as well. Trevor Moore, comedian, whitest kids you know. I just rewatched Miss March the other day that he stars in. he's a funny dude. And, you know, he's got a new special out on Comedy Central, and it's one that you got to watch. So we are here today, and we're going to kick it off with Dean Devlin. But once again, I just want to thank everybody around the world. Man, Pat and I are just like blown away that we do this hard work, and you never know who you're doing it for, because I don't like numbers. They scare me. And you know, and then we find out that worldwide we have an audience, and a big one. Thank you. Thank you very much. And let's open things with Dean Devlin. He has a new movie, Bad Samaritan, which is coming into theaters Friday, and with David Tennant as a star. So let's talk to Dean Devlin, and I'll be back, and then we will also talk with Trevor Moore. Thank you. Hi, Dean. Matthew Aaron.
Hello?
Yes, Dean. How are you? Matthew Aaron.
Nice to talk to you, man. How you doing?
Nice to talk to you, Dean Devlin. I got to tell you, man, we've been trying to get you on the show 4 years, ever since we started. Of course, when I was 13, one of the life-changing events in my life was sitting first row at an Independence Day opening night.
Love that story.
Yeah, but I think it came out like on July 2nd or something. It was a huge day for me. Yep. That was like insane for me.
Which city were you?
I'm in Chicago, so that was that was like
fantastic.
That was a big moment. And it was the first time I saw a movie like that, like on that scale, on like. To me, that was like, you know, what Marvel movies must be to kids right now. And then just showed my six-year-old Geostorm the other day. So that was kind of like his introduction. Because he loved Geostorm. He loved it. All the disaster porn that you have kind of become synonymous with. And now, but what a... What I love about your career, and it really is one of the most eclectic careers ever, because you were an actor, you've done everything. And now we have Bad Samaritan coming out with David Tennant, which is kind of like a Rear Window or a Disturbia or Don't Breathe.
Yeah.
And you got this great little horror movie coming out. Where did this come from? How did you get involved with Bad Samaritan?
Honestly, it was pure luck. I've known the writer for many, many years, ever since he wrote the movie At Pupil.
No, great.
And he called me up out of the blue and said he had just finished a new script and would I give him some notes on it before he started sending it out? And I said, sure. And he sent it to me. And I said, well, I only have one note, and that's don't show this to anyone because I want it.
Wow.
And I bought the script from him immediately, and I made it a priority to get the movie made.
Now, when did you buy the script? Like, when? What was the timing of all this, you think?
I think it was like either 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay. So this was before you just did. For those that don't know, your first film of directing, I believe, was Geostorm. So this was before that.
Yeah, although it was supposed to be this one. I mean, this is the one I wanted to do, and then suddenly, Roland Emmerich talked me into doing the sequel of Independence Day at Fox, and then Geostorm started to kick up, and I said, all right, I'll just put this on hold and do these other things. But the minute those were over, it's like all I wanted to do was get back to doing this movie.
Okay, so that's interesting because I'm sure you're doing the press tour and a lot of people are like, oh, after doing a big movie like Geostorm, you wanted to come do a horror movie like Bad Samaritan, or a thriller, I guess, is more accurate. And you're kind of like, no, I always wanted to do this one first, actually. This was in motion before.
And honestly, it's not a matter of big versus small. It's more about studio versus independent.
Yes.
I found over the years that my best work has always been when I've been able to work independently, that I just am not built. I don't have the personality type to succeed at studios. Mm. So whenever I've been able to work independently, I've always made better product.
Yeah, well, and you've always been very hands-on, though. You're even as a producer, and you worked with Roland on numerous films. So I have to imagine, even when you did Geostorm, you had a better idea than I would have as I'm an independent filmmaker. If I went to go do a studio film, I'm sure there were a lot of things that I've never seen before or never been told before, or whatever the deal is. It's a different game. Was there anything different for you when you did Geostorm, even though you had all the experience with all the previous movies? Was there anything surprising for you?
Well, the biggest surprise was all the changes that had happened at the studios. The way in which you function within a studio was very, very different from, the days when I had been working with studios. Because remember, since 2004, I had basically been working independently. So it was really my first time back at studios, and I was not prepared for how different it was now.
Yeah.
And it became very clear very quickly that it's not the right place for me.
Mm. Interesting. And so then you end up doing Bad Samaritan, and this one, you're the boss on it. You're the director, but you also get to be the boss because I believe it's your company, right? It's Electric, right?
That's right.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, we financed it, we produced it, and now we're distributing it.
Yeah,
so it's really...
I saw that. That's
independent
wild.
On every single level.
That's wild. Congratulations. I saw that you were distributing it because I was looking, and I'm like, this must be a typo or something because it says Electric is distributing. But no, and that's incredible. Let me ask you something. When you're the boss like that, and it's independent... I write and direct and produce my movies and I act in some of them. It's kind of crazy how I saw Independence Day and I go, boy, I kind of want to be like Dean. And then, it's kind of started out that way. But it's so weird. But because you were an actor, you were in Real Genius. You were in a bunch of stuff.
That's right.
So when you're doing Bad Samaritan, who are the people you go to for notes? So it's not just like whatever, is there someone that checks your work, I guess I would say?
Yeah, I mean, it was very collaborative. I mean, first of all, the writer, there's this tendency in Hollywood now to just hire teams and teams and teams of writers and bring in someone to rewrite this character and bring in someone to rewrite that third act. And, and I just don't believe in that, so Brandon Boyce wrote the original draft and he wrote every draft after that. And he was with me throughout all pre-production. He sat next to me every single day of the shoot, and he was there in the editing suite with me. And, my producers are part of my team and partners in my company. And, so we all really worked together. And I got to use the crew that I've been working with for 10 years. And so we knew each other. The DP and I have done almost 200 hours of entertainment together. So, there was a familiarity and a trust between, the department heads and the other people within my company and the producers and the writer. So it really was collaborative, but they always say Hollywood's a collaborative business. What they really mean is you got to take their goddamn notes.
Yeah.
But what this was really a group of people who were much more missionaries than they were mercenaries.
That's great. So you guys work together on this thing, and that's a big deal, at least for you to feel like you're succeeding. Did you feel like you had that kind of creative freedom when you were writing for, like, say, Roland, or when you did, like, Universal Soldier, Stargate? Did you feel like you had that kind of creative freedom then, too?
Well, Stargate was 100% independent. You know, yep. We raised the money out of France. We made the movie independently. Every single studio in Hollywood turned it down because they said science fiction is a dead genre. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we only ended up at MGM because they had nothing to release for all of October and November. And so they needed something to fill their distribution slot. So we convinced them to release the film. But they didn't even believe in it.
That's wild.
And Independence Day, you know, we wrote that again. We spec'd that script outside of the system. And at the time, 9 studios bid on the script. And because we had 9 studios bidding on it, we were able to make a deal where not only did we have total creative control, we also had marketing control, which was unheard of in those days.
I mean, I'm just kind of blown away from talking to you, learning about how everyone would assume you're one of the biggest studio guys of the last 30 years, but you've actually been very independent. Very.
That's right.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, wow, yeah. That's wild. Wow. That is, I mean, I don't have anything else other than that's awesome. I think that's so awesome that you've been able to do that all these years. What about on the TV side? Is that a pretty independent process for you, too, with, like, the librarians and leverage? Was that something you were able to just... run with?
In fact, it's even more independent because we were the studio on it. We deficit financed it. We own the shows.
Yeah.
You know, it. There's been a big change in the relationship of movies and television. You know, when I started out, television was very formulaic, you know, and there was a lot of voices in it. And you couldn't, there's so many could do's and can't do's. But movies is where you were able to do really interesting and provocative work. Well, over the years, movies have gotten more and more expensive to make and market, and everyone's more worried about screwing up a big movie. And so now you've got a billion people involved in making a big movie, and it's filled with do's and don'ts and too many voices. And conversely, there's now 500 television channels, and the only way for any of these channels to get seen or heard is to do something provocative and interesting. So more and more, we're finding the more interesting directing, the more interesting writing, the more interesting acting, all seems to be happening on television. And movies are becoming a little bit more and more predictable.
Yeah, they sure are. I haven't seen the new Avengers yet. And I'm a little skeptical. Like, I know everyone loves it, but I feel like they're all the same movie. They're not bad. It's just all the same movie. So I'm interested. But I get that same feeling. I noticed...
But I'm not even suggesting that these movies are bad. What I'm suggesting is that there needs to be more on the menu than just the big giant blockbuster or the tiny, you know, micro-budgeted little movie. And there was a whole swath of menu items in between these two that studios used to make regularly, and they don't make them anymore.
Yeah, like those $50 million
still
movies.
Are hungry for them. And when they do somehow pop up like a Baby Driver,
yeah,
people go crazy over them.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Yeah, no, they're not making those anymore. When I sat down with Christian Kane, he was on set of your show at the time, and I noticed that Bad Samaritan was set in Portland. Did you shoot this in Portland as well?
Yeah, absolutely.
So is that like a thing
absolutely.
For you?
We shot it in between season 3 and 4 of The Librarians.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Which, by the way, great show, The Librarians. I really love that show. I'm glad it was on as long as it was on. And but with Portland, do you love? Was that something that you wanted, or was it just a coincidence that it was in the script, or how did you decide to shoot?
No, the script originally was written for Los Angeles,
okay.
And I asked the writer if he would fly up to Portland and visit me while I was shooting The Librarians, because I wanted him to see the city. Mm. Because the thing that's so interesting about Portland is it has all of the accoutrements of a big, giant city.
Yeah.
But in its heart and soul, it's a small town. Everybody knows everybody. There's no secrets in Portland. So to me, that really amped up the stakes in the movie. In other words, a lot of the stuff, when especially when Kale is trying to take apart our hero's life bit by bit, if that were to happen in Los Angeles, a lot of people would just shrug. But in Portland, it would be career ending. It would, you know, that rumor and innuendo that our villain was spreading would literally destroy lives.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And Portland is, it's like the greatest small city in America. So I was very intrigued on, like, it seems you're really into Portland, and I was just kind of wondering if this was happenstance or another Dean really loves Portland. I mean, you're really doing that city justice.
Probably all of the above.
By the way, the librarians, I heard that you've been shopping it around to other networks, other outlets. Is that still something that's possible?
Well, I would put it this way: the patient is getting sicker all the time, yeah. but she ain't dead yet. So we're still fighting. I mean, the greatest compliment was the day that it was canceled. I got a call from 7 other networks asking, you know, about the show. So that was an enormous compliment to the show.
Wow.
As time has gone by one, they're starting to fall out. So we're down to you know, our last two, and so I'm trying to see if I can make it happen.
And then, you know, just because I know people listening are always curious about these sort of things, the Stargate reboot, Independence Day 3, any kind of movement on those projects?
I really don't know. After Geostorm, I really came to the realization that I'm not the kind of guy who should ever work at studios.
Yeah.
So, I excused myself both from Stargate and Independence Day. So they may be going forward, but I don't know. I'm not involved anymore.
Well, I got to tell you, man, I think that is definitely, obviously, the ballsier choice to make. So I'm always a fan of that. The studio system, that's a safe way to go if you follow the rules. But I kind of love the fact that you like doing things the way you want to do them. And Bad Samaritan, man, I'm so impressed by the way this has come together. I'm so impressed that you're putting it out yourself. It's man, you know, a lot of people talk about how they want to see the business change, but you're putting your money where your mouth is, and I think that's awesome.
Well, we're giving it a try. You know, we're trying to see if we can do it. It's a bottom to top effort as opposed to a top to bottom, meaning, you know, the studios spend a lot of money and they tell you, you're going to love this film. And then people go, oh, yeah, I love it, or they don't love it. We're kind of doing it the opposite. We don't have enough money to put billboards up and to do all the traditional things. So we're just basically running around screening the movie for people and hoping that they like the movie and that they tell their friends to go see it. So if this movie succeeds, it'll be 100% because the fans support it.
Did you test the movie as well? Was that something that you did since you were distributing it? And how'd you go about testing it? Like, was it the studio way, or did you have your own unique way of testing the film?
No, we use the same testing group that I've used on all my films my whole career.
Okay.
I'm actually somebody who believes very heavily in testing movies, but the difference between me, I think, and the studios is I believe that the filmmaker needs to interpret the test and not the studio. And I'll give you a fast example if I can.
Sure.
When I did Stargate, the very first test screening went terribly, and the audience said that the movie moved way too slow. And so, you know, our executive producers and financier said, oh, it's because there's not enough action and there's too much talking. And they insisted that we shoot another action sequence and that we lose a bunch of talky-talky scenes. And we did it. And we tested the film again. And our slow rating doubled. And so I said, I think I know why it's slow. It's slow because they're not engaged in our character. We don't have enough talking scenes. So we cut out the new action scene that we'd put in. We put back in all the talking scenes we had taken out, and then we added some more talking scenes that we had never put in because we had worried that there was too much. And all of a sudden, our slow rating vanished altogether.
Huh.
So it's not so much the testing, it's who's interpreting the results of the test. And I think as long as the filmmakers are the ones in charge of interpreting it, I think that testing is a very valuable tool.
No, I agree with you. The only studio experience I have is with television, and it's rough because you get the notes from the executives instead of, well, let me read the notes myself and let me figure it out. And, you know, they tell you what they want. And Yeah, I get it. I totally get where you're coming from that. Bad Samaritan, I got one more question about that, is David Tennant's involvement. Now, if you're doing this bottom to top like you were talking about, well, a great way to give yourself kind of a boost would be to cast somebody with as major a popularity as David Tennant, with the loyal fan base, the Doctor Who fan base. So what brought David onto this project? Is he someone you always wanted? Was this strategical in a way? How'd that come about?
No, this is pure desire to work with an actor. I mean, I've been wanting to work with David for a while, you know, and I was pushing him on both of my last two studio films, and the studios said, oh, he's not a movie star. And I said, you're insane. I said, that's like when people told me Will Smith wasn't a movie star when I wanted him in Independence Day. It's just short-sighted. And so, you know, that was one of the reasons why I wanted to do this movie independently, because I wanted to cast David Tennant and Robbie Sheehan. I knew these two are going to be just amazing actors. And now, you know, they're both blowing up. You know, Robbie Sheehan is now the lead of the new Peter Jackson trilogy. So, you know, by Christmas this year, he's going to be a gigantic star and unreachable.
Yeah.
You know, but at the time I was doing this movie, if it was at a studio, they'd say, oh, he's not bankable. You know, it's just insanity. To me, cast great actors and you will never go wrong.
Yeah, and David Tennant, what was the moment where you're like, I got to work with David Tennant? Are you a Doctor Who fan? Or what was it for you that said, I got to get David Tennant?
Well, I'm a huge Doctor Who nerd, and he was my favorite Doctor. But it was really when I saw him in Broadchurch in such a totally different character, and then, of course, Kilgrave, three remarkably different characters, and I felt as much passion for each one of them. And that's when I knew, that's remarkable. Normally, we tolerate our favorite actor doing something out of the box, but we love them doing the thing that we fall in love with them. This guy, you fall in love with whatever he does, because he does it with such commitment, passion, and skill. So there was no one I wanted more than David Tennant for this part.
That's great. And my last question for you is this is a personal question on my end, is, I read an interview you did years ago, and of course, I've been following your career since as young as I can remember. And you talked about how, and I thought this was very honest of you, and obviously your career has been a huge success, so it didn't really matter. But you talked about how you made some mistakes when you wrote Godzilla, but you learned from those mistakes. What did you learn from those mistakes, though? That's one thing they didn't follow up on in that interview, and I was very curious about, as one writer to another, what is it that you learned?
Well, there were several things, but I would say, just structurally as a writer, you know, we had thought that it would be interesting to play with the format. In other words, the format of writing is set up conflict resolution.
Sure.
And you set up your characters, you put them into a conflict, and then you resolve the conflict. And we thought, what if we just throw you into the movie, into the excitement of the movie? We just open, we'll be really exciting, throw these characters into it, and then in the natural lull of the second act, then we'll exposit their characters and tell you who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a giant mistake, because audiences make up their mind how they feel about characters very, very quickly. So if you don't give them the right information early, they can make up their mind about your character, and there's nothing you can do about it later, no matter what information you give. It's too late. They already feel the way they feel. So that was a mistake. And then the other big giant mistake was something that sounded good on paper and was really bad for movie making, which was, Roland and I were talking about what Godzilla would be in real life. And Roland turned to me and he said, you know, Dean, a lizard is neither evil or good. It's a lizard. And if there happened to be one that was taller than the tallest building, that lizard, just being its natural self, would endanger us. It wouldn't hate us. It wouldn't want to hurt us. But it probably would end up hurting us just in the course of its normal life. And so he wanted to try and represent Godzilla as neither good nor evil. And while that makes some sense on an intellectual level, it left the audience and the filmmaking wondering, am I supposed to be rooting for Godzilla? Am I supposed to be scared of Godzilla? Am I supposed to care that he died at the end? Am I supposed to be happy he dies at the end? It was an enormous mistake.
Yeah, and then when they made this new Godzilla and this new King Kong, you could kind of tell they at least gave them some sort of, are they a good guy or a bad guy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They made a decision on how you're supposed to feel about them.
Yeah, right.
And I think that was a huge mistake that I made in the writing. And, you know, I think Roland did a great job directing the movie. I think the actors did a good job. I think the effects were dynamite. But, you know, if you make a mistake like that in a script, it's almost unrecoverable.
Well, I'll just never forget that trailer. And that was another one. At that time, you saw that trailer, and you're like, I've never seen a movie like this. I just remember, what was it? It was the old guy fishing on the boat, right? And then Godzilla comes in the teaser.
Well, that's what's so interesting is when people see the movie a second or third time, they end up liking it a lot more because they already know who the characters are, and they're starting the movie with information they didn't have before, and they've already made up their mind how they want to feel about Godzilla. So then they're actually able to appreciate the movie on another level.
Yeah, that's great. That's, you know what? I'm going to give it another watch. I think you're right. I'm going to give it another watch. Now you got to. And by the way, thank you for sharing that with us too, because there's a lot of people that listen to this show that want to be in the business, or they are in the business, and they write and they're, you know, whatever. And it's always nice to hear how the professionals that have been doing this for so long recovered from something, because it's usually a good lesson. And that's a great lesson right there. Character matters, and it matters out of the gate. That's how people are going to judge the rest of your movie. You're right. And the Stargate notes, that's great. Well, Bad Samaritan, everyone's got to see this thing. The trailer is dynamite. Did you have say in all the marketing, obviously, and everything? So you were in on the trailer.
We're the studio.
Yeah, so you were in the room when they're doing the trailer. I got to tell you, the trailer is outstanding.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, anyone sees this trailer, they're going to want to see the movie. So Bad Samaritan, David Tennant, and Dean, thank you so much for finally taking out some time to talk with us. And we really love what you do, man. And I'm a big fan, big fan.
Well, we'll make this a tradition starting now.
Good. I'm very grateful to hear that. Thank you, Dean. And I wish you the best of luck with this, man. And I'll see it, and I'll send you a note about it. I can't wait.
Terrific.
Thank you, Dean.
You see it with a crowd, and don't see it alone.
I promise. I will take somebody. I promise. Right. Thank you, Dean, so much. Yeah, okay.
Bye-bye.
That was Dean Devlin. I've been trying to get him on the show now for years, and he's a great interview. That was great. He was fantastic to talk to, and I hope Bad Samaritan's a huge hit, because Dean Devlin's not going anywhere, though. He's Dean Devlin. He's one of the most prolific producers of my lifetime. He's not going anywhere. Next week, by the way, we're going to have on Jim O'Hare, and we're going to have on the writer and director of The Book Club, Bill Holderman and Aaron Sims. That's going to be on next week's podcast. Jim O'Hare will be joining me from Landline, or Parks and Recs, whatever you remember him from. And we'll be also joined by Bill Holderman and Aaron Sims with The Book Club, Diane Keaton, Jane Fonda, Candice Bergen, Mary Steenburgen, a lot of worldwide stars for our worldwide audience. Up next is Trevor Moore. Trevor Moore is a really funny dude. The whitest kids you know from their days on IFC, if you saw it then. You know him from the movie Miss March. You know him from his previous comedy albums at Comedy Central. He has walked the prank over at Disney XD, it's called. Liam watches that station. I don't know too much about that station, but I know he's a fan. And so here we have Trevor Moore, who's talking about his new special, Story of Our Time. And by the way, this was another great experience. The Story of Our Times is Trevor Moore's new special, which you can find on ComedyCentral.com. You can find on the app. Easy to find, or you can download on digital download on iTunes and all that jazz. Here is Trevor Moore and I sitting down talking about the story of our times.
I'm good. How are you? Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I hear you just fine. If there's a problem on your end, I apologize. I don't know what it could be, but we got you just fine here.
Oh, no. I just I put on my headphones and I wanted to make sure they were working.
Oh, all good, so, man.
I hear you fine.
All good. Trevor Moore, The Story of Our Times. Good shit, man. Really good.
Thanks, dude. I talked to you during the 24 hours thing, right?
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you did. It was a lot of fun, man. I was watching that thing. Yeah. I don't know if I should say this. I wasn't watching while driving per se, but it was live on Facebook, and I'm driving around Milwaukee to Chicago, and you know, it was better than the radio, man.
Oh, well, that's great. Thank you for talking to us. It was a funny, like, accident, because I guess they gave me the wrong number to call, because I was supposed to be talking with the guys from Super Trooper.
I don't know. Weren't you surprised?
And then we talked to you, and then everyone on the phone lines liked you, and I liked you, so I was like, oh, let's try to call them back. Like, and so when we talked to you later. So
I'm like, what a disappointment they're going through right now.
No, everybody was into it. Yeah, it turns out we had over half a million viewers for that.
I was going to say, at any point in time, there was, I mean, me and a couple of my buddies were watching it, and the producer of our show, Pat Tobias, was watching it, and we all saw at any point in time, it was anywhere from, you know, like 10,000 people to like 50,000 people. It's just insane.
Yeah, we weren't expecting that at all.
On Facebook, maybe a couple hundred
people.
Right. On Facebook with a 24-hour thing. That's insane.
Yeah, what was really crazy is I guess they can look at the amount of people that watched through the whole 24 hours.
Yeah.
And it was like nuts. Like a lot of people I must have just left it on in the background and just kind of checked in every now and then as they went about their day.
Well, I thought it was a really cool thing to do, man. And, like, this whole thing is, I got to tell you, Comedy Central's always kind of ahead of the curve on this stuff. I remember I had a meeting with Gary Mann a few years ago, and Gary wanted me to, like, pitch him stuff. And like, Gary was so far ahead of the curve, man. I thought I was, like, pitching him Cheers when he wanted, like, Workaholics. And, like, I didn't know. Like, Comedy Central's so cool, man, that they got your special on this app. And if you would have told people, like, 5 years ago that you got a special on an app, no one would know anything about it. But now everybody knows everything about it.
Yeah, no, they've been fantastic to work with. I love being over there.
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. So now you guys are on the Comedy Central app, and you're also at ComedyCentral.com. But you could download the album as well, which, by the way, I believe is Comedy Central Records anyway. So it's all Comedy Central. They are backing you 100. Yeah.
they've got it all covered. They're great.
So Trevor Moore, the story of our times. I was a really big fan of this album once I went through it. I got to tell you, I think Bullies is, dude, that's got to be one of my favorite songs.
Oh, no way.
I laughed my ass off, but it's funny, it's one of those, it's funny because it's true. It really made you think about, For people listening, you gotta watch the special. You gotta listen to some of these songs. They're great. Bullies, for instance, is about, oh my God, we need to stop bullying everyone. Well, wait a minute. What if we stop bullying people that want to identify as a wolf?
Right.
And I'm just like, yeah, that's kind of the thing, isn't it?
Yeah. I just hope people realize that it's satire, and
sure.
I'm not really saying to go out and bully people. But I'm just saying, like, you know, well, we kind of need everybody. You can't crack down too hard on bullies.
That's right, and we're pro bully on this show. So I'm just kidding. what I was going to ask you though is how much of your comedy, especially since you do a lot of music, how much of it is coming from you, and how much of it's being funny?
Well, my first priority is always to be funny.
Yeah.
But I also usually, I mean, most of my stuff, like, I like it to have some sort of point behind it or some sort of just kind of statement on an issue or in this album, it was really just a statement on the time.
Yeah.
I think I mean, the whole album kind of, and the special is really just, you know, kind of, I don't know if it's me getting older or what it is, but it's just, you know, kind of the way I've been feeling over the last, you know, couple of years, which is just that everybody on each side has become so hyperbolic and you know, demonizing of the other side. And everybody is just kind of upset and angry and attacking everybody all the time. And it's just this weird space we've gotten in. And so I was just trying to make an album that basically kind of, you know, makes fun of both sides and just sort of is, like the whole end of the album is like the ending in that There's a Meteor Coming song, which is basically just telling everybody to just calm down for a minute. Like, you know,
there is a lot of extremism nowadays. And it's funny, I think that's personally, I think that's a great thing to base your album around. That's what our next film we're making is based around, is just how crazy everyone's gotten. You know, like, I remember after the Trump election, everyone was deleting their Trump friends. Everyone was deleting their Hillary friends on Facebook. It was getting ugly out there. You're kind of like, why are we getting this crazy about stuff? What would you
say? Yeah, go
ahead.
And it started, but, Oh, sorry.
No.
Even like it started before. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead. No, I'm sorry.
I was just saying, like, it's, I mean, it started like way, I mean, like, I remember, you know, like when Obama won.
Yeah.
Like how crazy the right went. And then being like, oh man, you guys need to dial it back a little. I mean, he's not Hitler. You know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, when Trump won, it kind of jumped the other way, where you're like, guys, everybody, like, can we, like, I'm a fairly politically apathetic person, you know? And it's just like both sides are just so crazy. It's nuts.
Does that make you more politically apathetic that people are crazy about this shit, or does that just come from your upbringing? What do you think that's from? Your political apathy.
I think it's my political apathy has kind of come from you know, as you get older and as you've seen both sides in power, not really seeing. I mean, the stuff that like used to make me mad as a kid, which was these, like, wars.
Yeah.
You know, it still seems like we're going to be going to war, you know, with these countries that we were already always planning on going to war with, no matter who's in office.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of it. Definitely the rise of the, you know, 24-hour news, and where everybody just kind of lives. Everyone just lives in their own bubbles. Like, yeah. Either you live in the MSNBC bubble, and then you basically live in the MSNBC reality, or you live in the Fox News bubble, and you live in the Fox News reality. It's just like we're not even on the same planet anymore.
No,
it's
you're
just
right.
Just everybody is dug in on their like camps, and they're just I don't know. It just seems like an incredibly dysfunctional way to try to have a country.
No, I agree with that. I can definitely see where you're coming from with all that. You and I have similar upbringings, where you grew up in a very Christian household. How has that affected your career at all? Like, what have you taken from that upbringing?
What have I taken from? I mean, you know, I think, you know, my parents were musicians, so that was, you know, like a big influence on my life.
And they were successful. They were successful musicians too.
Yeah, they were. They were. Yeah. They were successful Christian, you know, rock singers.
Right.
And so, like, I think kind of when I was growing up, because I grew up on the road, I just assumed that you. Basically, like, entertainment is what you did when you got old. Kind of thing. Like, I was like, well, that's what you do for a little, you know, kind of thing. And there's been a lot of interfamily, you know, drama between what I do versus what my parents would be wishing that I did. But there's still, like, You know, and I don't agree with my parents on a lot of issues. Like, you know, my parents are very conservative. But, like, even with the disagreement, there's still, like, love there.
Yeah.
You know, and there's still, like, you know, we still get along. We argue a lot, but we still get along. And I guess in a weird way, that's almost, as I've gotten older, that's been sort of a inspirational thing to me.
Sure.
In a way, as what is lacking. In the way that we just tackle things as a country.
Yeah, I mean I kind of imagined it's similar to, you know, my background is I have very conservative and Christian parents, and I'm out here making comedies and making these movies that, you know, some of them are a little more R-rated than others, and then your parents go see them at, like, the premieres and stuff, or on video on demand, whatever, and they're very supportive, but, like, you kind of know it's not your parents' favorite movie they ever saw. Like, I'm imagining The Whitest Kids You Know is not, like, your parents' favorite sketch comedy ever.
Oh, no. My dad would go and flag our videos on YouTube.
Oh, my God. Come on.
He would try to get them taken down for content. But then, and I kind of respect this,
no.
Like, he'd call me and tell me about it. He'd be like, yeah, I flagged this one video. I thought it was way inappropriate. And then he'd just start talking about the tree that fell down in the backyard and just switch topics. And so as much as I was like, Dad, what are you doing? You're trying to, like, I would also be like, all right, well, that's just a thing. And
flagging videos is just a small part of your dad's day. I don't know if you know that. Just
exactly.
Oh, that's
I also
great.
Didn't really take it personally because he was like, you know, he was always, you know, he would be the guy who would complain about the Howard Stern show and
sure.
stuff like that and try to get that taken down too. So it was I was like, all right, good company.
Well, that's the funny thing about my dad. My dad and I would listen to Howard Stern on the way to work. I used to work with him, and he'd be howling over. And then, you know, the moment there was, like, gay characters in my movie, my dad's like, well, I don't know about all that. I go, okay, well.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. He'll watch Howard Stern, yeah, all the tits he can take. But you put two gay guys in a movie, and you're taking it a little far here, Matt. you know,
I don't think my parents went to see my movie.
Really? Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think they just knew they weren't going to like it, so they went. Like, I think my parents have always been very supportive, and they're very happy that I'm doing well.
Yeah.
But they're not gonna, like, go see my movie.
I was gonna say, they gotta be proud of you, because they have to understand, especially from them being successful entertainers, how hard it is to make a check in this industry. Like, you know, it's not the easiest thing to do, and everyone wants to do it. So, yeah, they got to be a little proud. I remember when I heard of you, when I was living in L.A., I go to Cinephile every week, and I don't know if you know of Cinephile on Santa Monica Boulevard over there. Right?
Yeah, no, Josh Fatum is one of my closest friends.
Well, that's where that's what I was going to bring up. Josh was there, like, every day.
Oh.
He's there, like, every day. Like, I'm pretty sure he lives there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was just talking to them one day, and Josh was doing this show with you. I believe it was a show, right? And he's like...
We did tons of shows with you.
Oh, this one was the show where Trevor Moore does a talk show.
Oh, yes. Okay. That's like after Whitest Kids. Yeah.
Yes.
Like Josh and I did a.
I want to say this was like 2012 or so. And
Josh and I did like a talk show for a couple months.
Yeah, and this was my intro to you. And then we had the Whitest Kids You Know, I think it was on IFC or something like that where
mm-hmm. people,
yeah. And so I was just like, oh, this, you know, this guy's really cool. It's a, you know, I kind of miss the old video store atmosphere. Cinephile is one of the last places you can go, because these are the kind of cool conversations where you get introduced to artists and people that you don't get. I used to be a general manager at a video store when I was a kid. This is the stuff you talk about, though. This is where we would get introduced to the Whitest Kids You Know. That would be the atmosphere of doing it. Now it's kind of hard.
Yeah, the movie store and the record store. Those were I mean, Cinephile. I think we actually did a show at Cinephile.
Yep.
Once.
Yep. They started doing shows there for a short period of time. I believe it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe it. You know, Cinephile's funny because they got every movie ever made ever. It's just so great. I love that place so much. But, yeah, that was cool that Josh was that you and Josh did shows together, because I didn't know who Josh was either when we were there. We just thought he was, like, some nerdy kid that hangs out there. I mean, that's just how much, you know, it just feels like an old record or video store. It was great. And then I got to know you and Josh's stuff, and I thought you guys were great. I think...
Yeah, no, Josh was, like, one of our first friends in comedy when we started our show in New York.
Oh, wow.
He was, I guess, just visiting in town, but he came and he started doing a set, and then we just hit it off. And, you know, we did a 6-week tour with him where it was Josh, us, and Flogging Molly, I think. And we were just, he wasn't on the Flogging Molly one, but we did a 6-week tour with him where it was us and Josh just going around the country in a tour bus, like doing shows all over the place.
Oh, my God. That's so cool. What, you know, around this time when I got introduced to your comedy and Josh, what was the, you did Drunk Text to Myself around this time, I want to say, and what for you is the difference between these two albums? What for you is like, these are where I'm at in life, or what is it?
Yeah, well, there's three albums done with Comedy Central, which is Drunk Text, High in Church, and
High in Church was the first one, right?
Story of Our Times.
High in Church was the first one, right?
The first, what's the difference between this one and the first one?
No. I was just making sure. High in Church is the first one, right?
No, Drunk Text is the first
one. Oh, Drunk Text was. Okay. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, what are the differences between these albums? Do you feel like there's differences, or do you find your comedy to be just kind of like, this is a continuation of the last album?
I think, you know, I hope that I've matured as a songwriter through the three albums. Like, I keep liking the stuff on the new albums more than the ones in the past, which is good. I kind of am just like, they are very sort of personal in a sense, in the way that it's just what I'm feeling at the time. A lot of them are about, you know, kind of the mood, in the world at that point.
Yeah.
This one probably more than any of the others. But I remember, I had like an idea for like three albums, and I kind of strayed from it. They were almost going to be concept. And the first one was going to be a lot about authority. On that album, there's stuff called, like, there's like the Founding Fathers rap, which is basically about, you know, kind of the origins of our government and how and what it's kind of become now, kind of, and you know, kind of thing. And then the other one was like the Pope rap, which I was kind of talking about, you know, the Catholic Church and stuff like that. And then I wanted to do like the third one to be kind of more about us as like a people. I don't know. I didn't really stick with it, but that was like at the very beginning, that was like kind of my like, you know, idea of what I wanted to do. But then they kind of bled all over the place, because in the second album, I kind of started making it about us. Like it was about, like I did a song called The Ballad of Billy John, which is kind of about how, you know, what the internet has done to people and done to our sort of personalities. They kind of bled all into each other. So originally I had an idea of like, this album's going to be about this, this album's going to be about this, this album's going to be about this, but they kind of bled all over. So, I mean, it really is just kind of, you know, what I'm feeling about the current climate at the time.
Well, that's cool. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a lot of great artists. Pryor was that way. Carlin, that's the way it was. And I was just wondering, because you can thematically put some of your stuff together here if you wanted to. Like, bullies and my computer just became self-aware. You could kind of say this is like a millennials album, like a comment on this generation. You have the Kardashian segment. So yeah, but at the same time, I was just wondering, if that's kind of just like where your mind was at when you put it together.
Well, a lot of times, part of being someone who doesn't really fit in a political party.
Yeah.
I don't really agree with one party 100%, or even 75%. kind of thing. I'm kind of all over. I end up and being politically apathetic, I tend to kind of see the point on both sides in a lot of issues. And I don't say that thinking that, I don't know if that's a good thing or if that's just an indecisive thing, and so sometimes I'll just for example, Billy John is a very anti-bullying song.
Yeah.
And then I always thought that Bullies was in a weird, it's almost like, but here's the devil's advocate to the Ballad of Billy John. It's almost like, but on the other hand, there is this, kind of thing. So it's almost an addendum, not canceling it out, but I'm saying but there's two sides to every argument.
Yeah, I think as a comedian, I think one of the best jokes, to frame a joke is to be the devil's advocate on something very not popular. That's usually comedy gold, and that's what Bullies is. Yeah. No one's making the argument for Bullies.
No.
We appreciate your bravery.
And I'm not saying to go bully, but I'm saying but we can't go too crazy with this anti-bully stuff.
It's a very funny song, and at the same time, you kind of nod your head. I feel that. What's crazy about your career that I wanted to ask about was, how did you go from where you were at doing the Trevor Moore show over, I believe, you did on Public Access and all that, and then you end up at Saturday Night Live. What's the story from there to there?
Well, so I did my Public Access show for 2 or 3 years when I was a high schooler.
Yeah.
And it got popular because I grew up in Charlottesville, Virginia, which is a college town. And so it was popular with the University of Virginia students and all that. And so then it ended up getting bought by a guy who owned some PAX TV affiliate. And so right when I got out of high school, I basically I got to do my show for a job for a year. And then we got canceled. But so I did a year of my Public Access show with a higher budget. I got to hire my friends and everything. And then I was really just okay, this is what. And it was kind of a hybrid late night talk show / sketch show.
Yeah.
And I kind of really fell in love with sketch while I was doing it. And I was okay, I want to focus on sketch. This is something I really, I like doing. And so then when my show got canceled, I went up to New York to go to college, with, college just being a cover for my goal was really to basically get a sketch group and start, doing comedy up there in New York. And so we formed Whitest Kids at my college. And so I was just applying for internships while I was there. And there was an internship for Saturday Night Live. And I had gone home for the summer. So I was down in Virginia. So I got on a Greyhound bus and went up to the interview for the internship. It was just 8 hours up and then 8 hours back. And so I got there and I looked a mess because I'd just been on a bus for 8 hours. I had my backpack and everything. And I was kind of out of breath. I got in there and they're where'd you come from? And I was oh, I came from Charlottesville, Virginia. And they're wait, you came up here? You took a bus up here for this interview? And I was yeah. And they're all right, well, you can have the job then. So that's how I got to be like Lorne Michaels' intern.
And how were you able to like live? Like, did you have to move to New York? Like, what was the deal? How'd you do that every week?
Well, I know I was going to college.
Like, okay,
so I had just gone home for the summer, which is when the internship was.
I was going to say eight hours every week.
The internship was, but yeah, no, I wasn't taking the bus every week. No, but once the internship started, I was back up in New York going to college. So it was something I did while I was in school.
Very cool. I just got a couple more for you, and I'll let you go. But one was.
Sure.
We know you did Miss March, and I believe that was a Fox comedy, and then you guys did the Civil War on Drugs, which is really hard to find, and I wanted to ask you why that is. And then, but is there also a Whitest Kids You Know movie in the works? And if not, do you have any other features that you're working on?
Yeah. So, sorry. The reason it's hard to find the Civil War and a lot of our sketches in recent years is because I think – so what happened was the deal that we had with the network was that we would get the rights to the show after 5 years. So 5 years has passed. We own the rights to the whole show. Now, we've never cared about people putting it on YouTube, and we actually wish that the Civil War and everything was on YouTube, but I think when the network's rights were, you know, ending, they took their versions down, and a lot of the network's legal people would take down, like, fan uploads.
Right.
Which we always liked the fan uploads, because we're like, it just spreads awareness of the show, and it's actually just better for us, you know, but... So now, like, they did like a purge, and there's not a whole lot on there. So we're in the process, like right now, of getting it all re-uploaded. So we're gonna this year we should have everything back up there in like high quality. Civil War will be up there. We're trying to figure out how to get. We want to try to get Civil War a like limited theatrical run. And then there is a Whitest Kids movie that we just finished last year.
Oh, wow.
Writing.
Okay.
And we're also trying to pull the funding together for that right now, because that's the next thing that we all want to do. It's like our favorite thing we've ever written. So it's just, we just need to pull the money together for it. But we've all been really busy. Like, I know Zach does the show Wrecked for TBS.
Yeah.
I've been show running a Disney show for the last 3 years that I started with my friend. And then I've been like working on this album for the last year. So like we're now getting to a point where like this summer we're all going to be like, okay, let's focus on Whitest Kids for a little bit. Let's get, you know, all the stuff back online so that people can see it again. And let's get this second movie made.
That's good, man. I mean, look, you got that. It's a prank show at Disney, right?
Yeah, it's a hybrid. It's half prank, half scripted show.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So it's like, yeah.
Disney XD?
Created that like 3 years ago and been doing that since then.
Is that on Disney XD?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. I thought that was you. Okay. All right,
yeah.
Well, then my final question for you is about this album, and then now we know we got a Whitest Kids You Know movie maybe coming out, hopefully soon. You guys get together and you do that. But then what is next for you outside of this? Is it going to be the Whitest Kids You Know, or you got some other projects percolating as well?
I have a couple things that I'm working on that I can't really, like, you know, I'm not supposed to really talk about yet, you know, because they're you know, not at that stage. I want to focus my attention on getting like the next Whitest Kids thing out.
That's great.
So that would be hopefully the next thing. And then, you know, I love doing these albums and specials every like 2-3 years.
Yeah, that's really cool.
So like I kind of really like the pattern of that. you know, just kind of working on something for a year, dumping it out there, hitting like the internet with like 4 or 5 videos at once, and then just disappearing for another 2 years and going and like, you know, drinking on my deck and writing what the next thing will be.
I was going to say, you got to have some time to write. I love this marriage of you and Nick Goosen, though. I think Nicholas Goosen, I think he is so underrated. I think he's such a great talent, man. Like, he just does
funny
shit.
He's become, like, a good friend of mine. Like, he did both of my specials. Like, he's awesome.
I think he's incredible. I think the marriage of your two together with this kind of thing is just, I think it's the best thing in the world. I think that's awesome. That's a guy that should direct the Whitest Kids You Know movie, man. He's great.
Yeah.
He's
insanely talented.
Insanely talented. Yeah. Everything he does, fucking funny, man. And same with you. And I just wanted to wish you the best on things moving forward and hope we could touch base again. And big fan, man.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, I would love to.
Okay,
would love to.
Great. And then for everybody out there, Trevor Moore, The Story of Our Times, you can get that on the Comedy Central app. You can go to comedycentral.com. It is available for purchase if you like the version with all the F-words. You can, because I don't think the F-words are on the comedycentral.com, right? Do you got to bleep anything?
Yeah, I think it's like you have to download that.
Yeah. You have to download for F words. So, and that's where the big bucks are at. So download it. Get your F words. I just wanted to thank Trevor for coming on. You're a great dude, man. I had a lot of fun doing the marathon, the Trevathon. And dude, I wish you nothing but the best, man.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was great talking to you here. It was great talking to the marathon. I like you, dude. You're
thanks,
cool.
Man. Thanks. Thanks for taking time out, and the best to you, brother.
Thank you.
Thank you, man. Have a good
talk
morning.
To you soon.
All right, I want to thank Trevor Moore and Dean Devlin, our guests today. Dean Devlin, Bad Samaritan, is in theaters Friday, and Trevor Moore's The Story of Our Times is on Comedy Central's app or going to comedycentral.com now. You could also download it on digital now, and it is really, really funny. Thank you guys so much for joining us. I'm going to wrap this up in about 1 hour and 2 minutes. I wish it was just an hour. 1 hour and 2 minutes. We're over time. Remember when we had overtime on this show? I kind of like this new show, by the way, where I do like an hour in, out. You get to listen to it on your treadmill or whatever you do. And you get to listen to the stars. So thank you very much for tuning in and to our worldwide audience, as Pat and I were just discussing. So awesome. Please keep listening. And next week, Jim O'Hare and the writers, director of the book club, Bill Holderman, Aaron Sims. We will talk to you next week. Good night.